Welcome to the Global Governance Podcast, where we explore the future of governance. Each episode will look at a different global issue and how governance plays a key role in its solution. From climate change to gender equality, from corruption to peace and security, we invite experts to explore a thought-provoking game of what if and why not, positing a world in much closer international cooperation. And now your host, Augusto López Claus. Enjoy.
Maria Fernanda Espinosa is an Ecuadorian academic, diplomat, linguist, and poet. She first worked with indigenous people and women in tropical rainforest stewardship in the Ecuadorian Amazon and became regional director of the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, specializing in multilateral negotiations on climate change, biodiversity policy, genetic resources, traditional knowledge, and intellectual property rights. She has served as Minister of Foreign Affairs, Trade and Integration, as an ambassador and permanent representative of Ecuador to the United Nations, as Minister of Natural and Cultural Heritage, and as Minister of National Defense. In 2018, she was elected president of the 73rd session of the UN General Assembly, the fourth woman in history to preside over this body. Ms. Espinosa has received numerous awards for her research and academic work on the Amazon for defending the rights of indigenous people and persons with disabilities. In 2019, the BBC named her one of the world's 100 most influential women. Maria Fernanda, thank you for agreeing to participate in this podcast. We are very grateful for your time today and look forward to hearing some of your insights. Let me begin by saying you have an impressive body of experience addressing a variety of currently topical issues, including gender equality, sustainability, and global health, to name a few. At a glance, many of these issues can seem somewhat unrelated. I therefore wanted to begin by asking you, what is the common thread linking your involvement over the years in these vital questions?
Thank you, Augusto. I'm really happy to be here with you and having this conversation. Your question is so many themes: gender equality, climate change, the rights of indigenous peoples. What is the common thread? What is the common denominator? And the common denominator, I would say, is about fighting inequalities, it is about social justice, and it is about new designs of societies and economies. And I think that the main challenge of our times is this rupture, this divorce between human societies, the economy, politics, and nature. And I think that if you want to understand what is going on, you really need to look at the world holistically. And the place where you can put everything together in a way is the multilateral settings. Even though we tend to think and operate and discuss and design in silos thematically, I think that's precisely one of the problems. We are equipped with a way of thinking that separates and divides issues, you know, and what we need is the opposite, is the need to understand the way societies behave, institutions behave, and where are the flaws and how we can make them, you know, improve the way they operate. And that's basically my interest in looking at the opportunities, the challenges, the flaws, the dysfunctions, the dystopias created by societies and institutions, and come up with hope, with potential avenues of solutions and alternatives. And here I'm saying this in a very humble way, Augusto. It's not that I have the answer for everything, but I think it's very, very important to look at the world in its complexity, in its diversity, and from a holistic perspective.
I have noticed that at the basis of much of your work in these areas is the promotion of the concept of multilateralism. For example, you have a whole section in your website dedicated to this subject and have written and talked extensively about its importance. For instance, at the World Future Council. For the benefit of our listeners, could you give us a brief overview of what exactly multilateralism entails and what its positive impacts and challenges have been in the last few years?
Well, first of all, Augusto, when we are asked to pronounce the word multilateralism, you know, it expresses, it's so difficult to even pronounce the word, you know? And sometimes it's also challenging to define what it means. And in basically, it is very simple. Multilateralism is two or more than two parties coming together to address, discuss, solve a problem. And the center of gravity of multilateralism, the place where all countries, all societies and all stakeholders come together is the United Nations. Multilateralism is it's connected to solidarity, to cooperation, to concerted action, to addressing with a shared responsibility our commons, our common goods as well. So basically, multilateralism is about concerted action, is about collective responses to challenges. And it is, I think we all know that we are living times of hardship because the problems that humanity is facing are impossible to be addressed or resolved by individual states or individual societies. And I think if we talk about the climate crisis, the extinction crisis, the inequalities crisis, the global health crisis, and the COVID-19 pandemic, it is so clear. And the lessons that we have learned is that the go it alone, the national interest first, really do not work. Because in the world of today that is so interconnected and where humans and societies are so interdependent, we do need these multilateral responses, and we need strong and capable and efficient institutions to deliver these collective solutions, to establish the proper platforms for shared understanding and for concerted responses. And that's precisely what when I say this, is common sense, you know, solidarity, collective action. These are already made phrases, and it's like a very matter of fact. But unfortunately, it is not happening. And the most palpable, obvious example is how we have responded to the COVID-19 pandemic. And the vaccine inequality and the staggering inequalities overall in what has happened as the world tried to respond to this pandemic, which has been a part of our lives, of our decisions, of our ways of communicating, of our interactions as humans, of our economies for more than 2 years. And yet we are unable to do the things that we need to do, starting by ensuring that everybody in this planet has a vaccine, access to a vaccine. And we know that inequalities have played its part again. You know, Africa, some poor countries in the global south having, 6% of their population vaccinated, while the northern countries basically are reaching 80 or more than 90% of people vaccinated with at least one or two doses. And now we are even thinking about a fourth booster shot in the northern hemisphere when in countries of Africa or in Latin America, like Haiti, they're really begging for a first dose for their people. So the issue of solidarity, of cooperation, of collective action, of multilateral responses is not that obvious. And I think that that's why we are here. We continue to trust multilateralism. We continue to have faith and hope that we will, as humanity, be able to do what we need to do. And that requires co-responsibility, requires leadership, requires vision, and requires also responsibility with the future generations.
Maria Fernanda, in December last year, you helped publish a report for the Lancet COVID-19 Commission, which highlights the importance of multilateral institutions like the UN and the World Health Organization when responding to the COVID-19 pandemic. In your view, what are some of the most pressing reforms that have been identified in the report?
Well, yes, indeed. I started, Augusto, mentioning some of the flaws, the challenges. And I think that the COVID-19 pandemic has been a litmus test for the multilateral system. And it has really put under a lot of stress, you know, multilateral institutions, including the WHO, including the entire UN architecture. And I think that we have to learn from experience. We have to learn from what happened. And basically, for example, we saw that the UN General Assembly, like the parliament of humanity, was unprepared. And as former president of the UN General Assembly, I can tell you there was no plan B for the working methods of the General Assembly. And there were several months had to pass to readjust, to understand how, for example, member states could vote on a resolution virtually, what were the technologies that needed to operate. From this very specific example to bigger examples. And basically, we learned that in times of pandemics or in times of crisis, to centralize decision-making is extremely important. And the role of WHO, for example, what happened? The UN suffers from, you know, it's chronically underfunded. And the first, if we all remember, the call and the pledges for a humanitarian fund to respond to the areas, the conflict areas and places where a humanitarian need was required, an emergency platform. Everything was underfunded, and there were no mechanisms in place to respond to a pandemic of the dimensions of COVID-19. So from the working method side, from the financial side, from the coordination side, let's also remember that the Security Council took, I think, 4 or 5 months to agree on a resolution calling for a global ceasefire because we were in state of emergency. So we have learned the hard way. For example, the lack of a protocol. We have an international health regulations, but we didn't have protocols, for example, for air travel. Until today, as we speak, we don't have clarity. It's like in a case by case, airline by airline, but we do not have mandatory protocols in situations like this. The IMO, the International Maritime Organization, in terms of ensuring the supply chains in times of crisis. So all these institutions that we have created, and by the way, IMO and ICAO, the International Civil Aviation Organization, are both UN organizations. And in my opinion, we lacked centralized head in this case, in my opinion, it has to be WHO establishing, you know, all the protocols, not only on the health, but on the procurement and ensuring that the supply chains were guaranteed, et cetera, et cetera. I think that we have learned from all these challenges that we faced. And on a positive note, however, Augusto, let's remember that scientific cooperation did work during the pandemic. And that was a high point, let's say, of the crisis. We were able to develop a vaccine in record time in a year. That is unprecedented in the history of science. But then the challenge came with the access, the deployment, the discussions unresolved until today on intellectual property waiver mechanisms to expand the capacity of other countries to produce the vaccine, especially from the global south, et cetera, et cetera. So this is what we learn. And we also learn that the countries that have strong universal health coverage, strong health systems, were more prepared and more resilient to respond to a pandemic of the dimensions of the COVID of the COVID 19. We also looked at the we said the positive note, a good scientific collaboration, but also I would say the acknowledgement of the importance of local governments, of municipalities, of grassroots organizations getting organized to respond to the pandemic. So we learned a lot. But basically, the big lesson here is that no single country, region, institution, or sector can address the consequence. The consequences of a pandemic, or, you know, let's use the climate crisis alone. So we need, on situations of crisis, of global hardship, we need coordinated global action and a stronger sense of transnational solidarity, which did not happen. And until this day, we see that it's not happening as it should. And basically, I think that we are in times of crisis, but at the same time, in times of enormous creativity. Our Common Agenda report from the Secretary General from last September has unleashed a process, a very vibrant process where member states, civil society, think tanks, academia are thinking on what is that we need to fix or how to rethink the global governance arrangements that we have designed, and especially looking at the UN. And there are so many, you know, excellent ideas out there. The Global Resilience Council, the establishment of an emergency platform, how to rethink and the WHO and the WHO governance. And here I think it's a serious issue. And I mentioned, Augusto, that the chronic underfunding of the UN. And let's just think for a moment that the United Nations has a little more than $3 billion to operate every year and to solve every problem in 193 countries, $3.1 billion, if I'm not mistaken, for in the 2022 budget. WHO regular budget is 119 million, and it's really untenable. And the biggest amounts of resources that come to the UN or to the WHO, for that matter, are earmarked, are not core funding. So you can prepare and you have autonomy over how to better use the resources. And so this is a critical problem. And I recall that the UN was calling for this humanitarian emergency fund, and they were underfunded chronically during the peak period of COVID. And the European Union came together And in one day, they raised $8 billion for vaccine development. I don't know if we remember that, but we should not forget $8 billion in one day. And the budget for the UN for 1 year, for 2022, is $3.12 billion. So I think that the issue of resources is not an issue in itself. It's a symptom that we have a profound structural problem. And the good side, and I would like to end this question with a positive note, is that we are in a situation of crisis, and we have also the opportunity to rethink the system, to rebuild, to reset our multilateral system. And for that to happen, I think, of course, the main responsibility lies in member states. The UN is an intergovernmental space. But the voices of civil society, the creativity of societies, of thinkers, of young change makers from around the world, from think tanks, is so much needed at this moment. And that's why I see with great hope, there are no, you know, we're not in shortage of challenges here, but with great hope, these energy that has come up with the Our Common Agenda report. And I would leave it there for now, Augusto.
Your report has also raised another interesting point regarding the gender nature of the pandemic. For example, it is mentioned that out of 115 national COVID-19 task forces in 2020, 85% had a male-dominated leadership. Notwithstanding the fact, as I think about it, that a lot of the successful cases of COVID-19 management at the national level, I'm thinking of Iceland, Finland, Norway, New Zealand, Taiwan, Denmark, have been in countries led by women. In a previous article, Build Back Equal, you also noted that women's mental health, particularly those that are pregnant, postpartum, miscarrying, or are undergoing intimate partner violence, has also been disproportionately affected during the pandemic. Data has revealed that on average, more men than women are dying from COVID-19 on a global scale. So based on your past experiences, do you believe the pandemic has introduced a new dimension to gender-based inequalities? Or has the pandemic simply entrenched previously existing systematic discriminatory structures?
Well, I think that the COVID-19 pandemic is what I call a total social fact, using Marcel Mauss's category. And when I say it is a total social fact, because it has altered, it has magnified all the pre-existing inequalities in society. In not only inequalities, but the weaknesses of institutions to respond to a situation of crisis. And we have extensively discussed that during this conversation. In all inequalities and forms of discrimination are unacceptable, but when you think about exclusion and discrimination of 50% of the world's population, we are in deep trouble. And we have to say that even before the pandemic, women were already, excluded, discriminated against, victims of gender-based violence, etc., etc. Women already before the pandemic, they did three times more care work than men, and basically after the pandemic, what we saw is that, especially, I think this is a 2020 number. Women took on 173 extra hours of unpaid childcare compared to only 59 additional hours by men. So the increase in care work, incredible in some countries, increase of gender-based violence because of lockdowns, because women, the households had tensions because of the lockdowns, et cetera, et cetera. We saw that the victims in all fronts from the pandemic were women and girls. And when we say girls, basically the data shows that over 11 million girls may not go back to school after the COVID-19 crisis. The society understood that it was very profitable to have women at home doing unpaid care work, for example. And we know that when girls do not go back to school, this increases automatically the risk of adolescent pregnancy, of child marriage, and of domestic violence against women. And you said something that is so true, Augusto. In all these national mechanisms to deal with the pandemic, 80% of the leadership were men. Considering that above 73%, 75% of the health workforce are women. So here again, you have numbers that are even difficult to explain. And the paradox is what you just said. Women in positions of leadership, presidents, prime ministers, show that they could deal better with the pandemic. New Zealand, you mentioned Finland. I have to mention a person of my own region, the Prime Minister of Barbados, not working only for Barbados, but for the unity of Caribbean countries, mayors, community leaders, women really making the difference. And we haven't learned because I have to share, some bad news again, because I think 2 weeks ago, the WHO executive board met, and the presence of women in the executive board of WHO was 6% of women. And, a huge decrease from 2019 or 2020. I think the numbers in 2019 were 20% women. In the last executive board, 6% of women represented in the executive board. So there is a lot to do. And these are not, Augusto, only about numbers. It's not only the arithmetics of inequality, of gender inequality. It is about the quality of the decisions that we take. It is about the quality of our democracies. It is about fundamental women's rights and girls' rights to be properly represented and participate. So this has been also a big lesson that we have learned from COVID-19.
Maria Fernanda, you also have extensive experience in navigating and responding to questions about climate change. A core issue in COP26 centered on the importance of limiting global warming to 2.5 degrees to mitigate the most severe impacts of climate change. A colleague of mine, Arthur Dahl, a top environmental scientist, has recently written a paper in which he presents a compelling case for the creation of a global environmental agency. To move away from the current ad hocery that defines global environmental policy, with voluntary emission commitments which do not add up to a temperature rise that would safeguard future generations and our planet. Do you see us moving in the direction of binding commitments in a context of much stronger international cooperation? Or will we continue to dither until accelerating climate change and the associated catastrophes finally precipitate the reforms and changes we need? In this respect, I wonder, Maria Fernanda, what your overall impressions of last year's COP26 were. Were there any decisions or outcomes that stood out to you as a success or failure?
Well, I think that, as I mentioned at the beginning, these are symptoms that there is a civilizational crisis altogether. Because when we turn to COVID-19, we can see the flaws of the institutional responses and the multilateral system. When we look at climate, we also see that so many, weaknesses. And when you look at gender transactional inequalities, then you see that there is a problem. And these are only symptoms that basically we need to rethink our relationship, with the economy, with nature, our relationship between us humans, this principle of interconnectedness, of interdependence, is more important than ever. And yes, the climate crisis is there. We can touch it. There are millions of climate refugees worldwide. Migration is going to end up being the ultimate adaptation outlet. No, so the situation is we know that even if every country complies with all the NDCs, the National Determined Contributions, and complies with the Paris Agreement, it's still insufficient to reach the 1.5 degrees. And we already know that it's going to be extremely difficult because the path and the rhythm that countries are going is really not pointing in the right direction. And basically, you said there is an idea of establishing a global environmental agency. And there is this unfinished project also that was mandated by the UN General Assembly of a global pact for the environment. And the negotiation simply stopped because of the lack of buy-in of some member states. And the truth is that the environmental crisis that goes beyond the climate, because we are facing an extinction crisis, we are facing a pollution crisis, it really requires some norms and standards that would use the principle of common but differentiated responsibilities. I am not sure. We tend to immediately come up, let's, create another institution because what we have is not good enough. Perhaps, to rethink about the original idea of a global pact for the environment would be useful. We have more than 1,000, and I'm not exaggerating, more than 1,000 multilateral environmental agreements. But what we have, basically, we are suffering from an implementation deficit, from an accountability deficit. And there are several initiatives out there, not only the Global Pact for the Environment, but there is a group of very young lawyers working to request an advisory opinion to the International Court of Justice on climate, being or affecting the fundamental rights of people because of inaction. A few months ago, the Human Rights Council passed a resolution establishing the right to a healthy environment as a human right, which is a major, I would say, success in the human rights architecture. So things are happening. There is a group of people working seriously on climate litigation, and that could, of course, encompass environmental litigation internationally. Using already successful examples, for example, the Potsdam case in Germany, and the Constitutional Court saying, yes, Germany didn't do enough against the climate crisis. So more and more you see, well, soft law doesn't work on this issue because the crisis is so profound. And I think that there are several ideas there that we need to consider. I am not sure how far the idea of a global environmental agency can go, or if it's going to have, the buy-in from member states. But at least to really consider the idea of a global pact for the environment, for example, to consider that nature that environmental services are a common heritage of humanity, for example, and that there is co-responsibility on that front. And I think that, again, the same example as the COVID-19 pandemic, if we take the climate example, we see that the climate crisis is human-made, and the solution needs to be also crafted by humans. So I don't think that indifference or losing hope is the solution. We don't have the right to lose hope and to continue working on this. But we have to be realistic. The situation, the world, multiple crises require concerted global action, require more multilateralism, but a redesigned multilateralism, a multilateralism 2.0, rejuvenated, more connected to the current reality. And you said it very well when you were, reminding us about the history of the United Nations. Yes, it was created after Second World War, just to prevent as an antidote, to not to repeat the massacre and the human suffering of the Second World War. But 76 years have passed. The reality and the geopolitical dynamics have changed. And I think that it is a time for us to really rejuvenate and modernize the system that we created 76 years ago.
Thank you, Maria Fernanda, for those very interesting insights. I wanted to pose the last question to you in this podcast. You know, at the Global Governance Forum, we strive to reach out to young people who will bear the brunt of our failures to address the multiple global challenges that we currently confront, from climate change to the dangers associated to the unraveling of our nuclear order in recent decades to issues of poverty and widening income disparities. Do you have any final comments or words of advice to these young voices so that far from becoming cynical and disappointed, they will find reasons for hope and concerted actions?
Well, I think that the role of young change makers, of young thinkers, of young activists is something that we hear in every corner, in every webinar, in every discussion. I think that there is universal acknowledgement that whatever happens and whatever the world decides in different spaces, we need the voices and the agencies and the agency of young people. Not only because they're creative, they're well connected, they understand better than we do what the problems are. They have sometimes bolder and more creative solutions than we do. So they are a fundamental part of the decision-making process. And that is a reality, in that it has been tested and proved that when you have young people, when you have a gender-balanced setting, when you have a diversity of views, is the best way to take decisions that last longer, that are sustainable, and that they are implementable and action-oriented, because there is co-responsibility and there is social ownership. And what I would say, I'm saying, what would you suggest or your advice? I receive advice from young thinkers every day, believe me. But the only thing I would say is that indifference is not an option. And that we do not have time for incremental change, for a band-aid approach. We are living a civilizational crisis, a universal crisis of values, of the way we function, that we produce and we consume. So there is no time for incremental change. We need a radical and rapid transformation. We need to redesign our systems, our ways of thinking and understanding the complexity of our reality. So I think that societies, social movements, science, young people have a central role to play here. So, and again, because we see that young people worldwide feel disappointed, feel frustrated. When you look at different measurements of trust, we are experiencing not only an implementation deficit, but a trust deficit, especially among young people. They cannot even imagine that their future is going to be better than ours. And this cannot be. We are all in the same boat in a way. So my final word to them perhaps is, we are co-responsible, and indifference is not an option. And here perhaps a quotation for this amazing writer, Nobel laureate Elie Wiesel, when he said that the opposite of love is not hate, but indifference. So once again, indifference is not an option.
Thank you for listening to the Global Governance Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with friends and family. To learn more, please visit globalgovernanceforum.org and join the conversation.